Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
And what we're going to do here is that we're going to sort of move on focusing on the people that are not in hospital. We're moving outside the hospital to focus on people who are not well, possibly long-term, but are not in hospital. So how can services be reconfigured? How can they be integrated better to effectively meet the level of need and to ensure that acute hospitals are only involved in doing what they're designed to do and that they're not housing people who could be cared for at home or elsewhere? So what we're going to do is we have our two speakers who've just spoken, which means that later on you have the chance to ask them questions as well. And then we have our panel of four people as well. And they're each going to speak for a few minutes, sort of three to five minutes on what they think about these issues. And then there'll be a chance for you to, I've got lots of questions for them, and there'll be a chance for you to ask some questions too. And I will introduce them one at a time as we go. And so if I can start with you, Professor Martin Marshall is Clinical Director and Director of Research and Development at the Health Foundation. And they've been doing a lot of work looking at business process reorganisations in the ward, or smart wards. Thank you.
Claudia, thank you very much. I've been working in the NHS for nearly 25 years, mostly as a GP. And if there's one thing that I've noticed consistently over the years, it's the extent to which those who work in the health or social care system tend to be very socialised into the system that they work in. They see a certain way of working, a certain way of delivering care for patients, and they can't see another way of delivering care for patients. And it seems to be that socialisation, that process that you see amongst people working in the health and social care system, is very deeply embedded. It means that we accept the successes, and I don't want to be too negative here, there are some enormous successes in the NHS. If I compare the NHS now with how it was when I qualified in the mid-80s, it's enormously better. But there are also a fair number of deficiencies in the service which the evidence consistently is pointing out and which we can't deny. Deficiencies in safety, for example. We know that 1 in 10 patients admitted to hospital are harmed by us, suffer iatrogenic harm. We know that only about 1 in 7 elderly patients with dementia who are given antipsychotics actually benefit from those, and most of the others suffer significant harm. We know there are significant problems with quality of care. Up to 50% of evidence-based processes that we know we should be carrying out, we don't carry out. We know there's significant waste of resources. We know there's significant deficiencies in the patient-centeredness of the care we provide. So there's lots and lots of problems. The issue for me is, how do we see those problems in such a way that allows us to think differently about the solutions? And that seems to me to be quite a big challenge. Voltaire once said that change happens not when you visit new lands, but when you see with new eyes. And the challenge for us working in the health and social care system is how we see these problems with new eyes. And that's something that we are trying to do in the Health Foundation. And I want to describe very briefly just three initiatives that we've either initiated or we've been involved in, which have helped us to put patients at the centre. And putting patients at the centre immediately makes the health system look very different. The first one I want to describe is shared decision-making. And shared decision-making, many of you will be familiar with it, is a process in which patients work with clinicians, doctors or nurses, in order to make decisions about mostly elective procedures or elective interventions in which there's genuine doubt about what the right answer is. So there's a genuine choice to be made. And in shared decision-making, we go through a systematic process. We're working with a couple of teams in Cardiff and in Newcastle in order to help patients to make better decisions in conjunction with their clinic, with their clinicians. And those processes that we're going through are, first of all, clearly using tools to clearly identify what the choices are. Secondly, to clearly identify what the risks and the benefits of those choices are. And thirdly, to identify what the likelihood of those risks or benefits happening. And we know from the evidence that going through a shared decision-making process, let's say for something like should a woman have a hysterectomy for heavy periods, for example, or should a man have a prostatectomy when they have prostatic problems. We know that when they share decisions, as opposed to when the decisions are made for them by the clinician, that there are very significant improved outcomes. Patients have greater self-efficacy. We know that they're much less likely to choose technical interventions, often expensive and unsafe interventions, in comparison with the decisions that clinicians would make. And we know that they are much more likely to use resources more effectively. So the demonstration projects that we're doing around shared decision making are attempting to help clinicians to make these decisions far more effectively than they might have done and really engage with the shared decision making process. The second example is around supported self-management, if you like, a broader concept than shared decision making. Supported self-management is when patients are much more involved in dictating the nature of their care. Again, we're doing some demonstration projects with patients who've got diabetes, depression, musculoskeletal problems, and heart disease. And with the patients that we're working with, in each of these cases, we're demonstrating that a systematic approach towards promoting supported self-management, an approach that helps to train the patients themselves to make better decisions, the clinicians to know how to engage properly with patients, and the environments, the work environments that they're in, to be more conducive. If we work on those three areas, then again, we've demonstrated significant improvements in the way that the decisions that are made, the outcomes of those decisions, and the use of resources. And the third example that I want to give is some work that we're doing, in a partner of ours is doing, a guy called John Moore, who's based at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston. Fascinating guy, trained as an engineer, then trained as a doctor, decided he didn't like the healthcare system, so he's opted out of medicine and is now doing a PhD at MIT, looking at redesigning the doctor's office. And he's redesigning it using fairly simple technologies, actually nothing particularly sophisticated. So, for example, before patients go to see their doctor, they have a conversation with an avatar doctor on a television screen or their computer screen or their mobile phone, and that avatar doctor takes a history so the information is available before they go into the consultation. They use a range of different mechanisms to monitoring devices, to take physiological measures, for example, blood pressure, pulse, temperature, whatever. And they use a range of different other devices in order to improve the nature of the information that then gets taken into the consultation. So the consultation doesn't start from a blank screen. It doesn't start from your dot. It starts from both the clinician and the patient having a clear idea of what needs to come out of it. The consultation is therefore much more intense. The time that's used is used much more effectively, and the outcomes of those consultations are also much more impressive. And the outcomes, the process, the follow-up to that consultation happens not synchronously, not calling the patient back when there's often better things that it can do, but done through mobile phone technology. So the doctor might record the result of advice arising from a consultation, and the patient picks that advice up on their mobile phone when they're going for a jog later on that evening or something like that. So there's a range of different technologies that can be used to completely change the relationship between patients and those who are delivering services. And that completely redefines what we mean by healthcare.
Yeah. Thank you. Very interesting. Next, we're going to hear from Sir Stephen Bubb, who's Chief Executive of the Association of Chief Executives of Voluntary Organisations. And he's also Chair for Choice and Competition Panel on the NHS Future Forum. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I wanted to take you up on something you said earlier, Claudia, when you said it's all about the patients. And I thought, well, do you know, that's the problem. And why is it a problem? First of all, I hate the term patient because it implies, more than implies, a power relationship between, you know, a sick person or a poorly person and a professional. And I try not to use the term, although we all know what it means, but I don't like it because of that power relationship issue. And what you've just been talking about, one of the best meetings I went to during the listening exercise was organised by the Health Foundation talking exactly about this shared decision-making, and it was very powerful, both in terms of, you know, long-term conditions and people with pretty serious needing surgery and actually having choices about whether it's invasive or whatever. It was fantastic. And I know there's some work going on, more needs to happen. That's one reason why I don't like the term patient. The second reason is there are at least 18 million people in the country with at least one long-term condition. Now, these are people who do not regard themselves as patients. I'm one of those. There'll be people in this room the same. We're citizens. We simply have health issues that we need managing. The fact is, one of the striking things, because as an outsider, it was the only outsider who chaired one of the Future Forum panels, and what struck me was the fact that we have a health service based on a model largely determined in 48, which is around acute care and hospitals. So all the debate, policy, finance, etc., discussions around acute hospital. And yet 75% of the health service budget is spent on long-term conditions and spent very badly. So what happens with me, with my diabetes? I get an annual checkup, and that's good. You know, they tickle my feet. And at some stage, perhaps, they'll tickle my feet and I won't feel it, and they'll chop off my leg. Now, the health service will do that very efficiently, I'm sure. I'll probably choose where I'm going to have my leg chopped off. But actually, I would like not to have my leg chopped off. I'd like a service that discussed with me how I'm going to live with that long-term condition. And what do we know about this? We know that organisations in the third sector, like Diabetes UK, they are networks of people with diabetes who know exactly what we need to do, exercise, diet control. And the health services, you know, why should the doctor provide that? What the doctor needs to do is point us to Diabetes UK, other organisations who will help us manage our condition. That's not happening. You could have a personal budget, for example, to enable me to buy a dog or, a fitness first membership, etc., because that's the sort of thing that is going to work. And that's not what we're doing. And we have to get a grip on. That's why the conclusion of my report on choice and competition, I can sum it up by saying competition is not a disease. We simply have to get a grip in the health service on the fact that competition can actually be beneficial and, in fact, in meeting financial challenges is going to be essential. And if you want greater choice in the health service, which we do, and which is guaranteed in the NHS Constitution but routinely ignored by the health service, we need a diversity of providers in the private sector and in the third sector. And it is time the health service got over this sort of privatisation's bad, it's all wicked, and we are actually the people to deliver it. Us professionals employed by the state are there to deliver it. And until we open up that service, I don't think we can meet the challenges I've outlined, and as well as the budget challenges.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Do you think we'll end up calling patients service users, like in mental health?
Well, I think, you know what, it's a horrible term as well, Sims. Yeah. I don't know what we do, but actually it's interesting. You know, all the debate recently about Circle taking over Hinchinbrook. I've seen the stuff they've done in Bath. I'm going down there next week. You know, and I think just the idea that they've actually provided them with superb food, right? Because, you know, they're treating them as customers. And, well, you know what the food's like in the health service. No one really cares about it, actually. But they've taken a different, because they do actually think of them as customers. And if we're citizens having paid for our health service, why shouldn't we be treated like customers, service users, whatever we call them?
Thank you. Well, next we're going to hear from Professor David Wellborn, who's Associate Director at the Centre for Better Managed Health and Social Care at Cass Business School, City University. And it may interest you to know that he's both a chartered engineer and a chartered physicist, rather impressively.
Thank you for that. Yeah, I think I may have some responsibility for the title for this, being a health and social care ecosystem. That stems from a conversation I had some time ago. And I want to start by looking at an ecosystem. What is an ecosystem? It's a common environment inhabited by different species in which each one adds value to the system and is influenced by the interactions, the interrelationships and interdependences. And when you say it like that, the health and social care system ought to follow that pattern. But an ecosystem does not have compartmentalised independent regions. It does not have boundaries. It does not have regions within which each unique species lives out its an independent life, unaffected by the species next door. So without rigid boundaries, without individual cultures, and without distinctive boundaries, a care ecosystem is a new world in that sense. And if we're going to see a new ecosystem of care, I think we need to gain a new respect and understanding for all of the species that live within that system, exactly as Stephen's just been outlining. The current debate, the Health and Social Care Bill debate, it's almost impossible to get beyond the second word of a sentence without half the audience instantly thinking about the NHS and its structures and its hierarchies and the emotional attachment that people have to some notion that the NHS has a set of values that no one else in the world espouses. And that emotional attachment results in a polarisation of the debate because the NHS puts some magic umbrella over healthcare in, I think, I'm saying the same as Stevens just said. But the reality, we need to understand the reality of the present if we are going to see the future ecosystem in a different light. And the reality of the present is that the NHS itself is over 400 distinct organisations. There are 25,000 partner organisations that work under the NHS umbrella. There are 25,000 organisations in addition to that who work under the social care umbrella. The NHS spends around 110 billion or so, but across the whole care ecosystem, there is 20 billion which is directly attributable to social care. There is another 70 billion that is attributable to other aspects of social welfare and housing, which have a direct impact on the provision of care. And there's 90 billion of value, not costed, but of value, which is provided by the 6 million people who deliver voluntary care for more than 10 hours a week, 175,000 of whom are under the age of 18. So the ecosystem which is care has a total value, a net worth, of £300 billion. And so when the debates always refer back to the hospital spends about 15% of the total value of the care ecosystem, and we all know that that should actually be less than 10% if we moved care to where it should be given. And yet, the debate is dominated by the world of the hospitals. So we don't understand what is already in the care ecosystem. And when we worry about the David Nicholson challenge of the 20 billion in order to cope with the demographic change, that 20 billion is much smaller when compared with the total size. And when we worry about the 2 to 4 billion pound gap that Dilnot exposed around end-of-life care, that becomes a relatively small drop in the ocean compared to the 90 billion which is provided by a value that's provided by the volunteers, that if the system was changed and that goodwill was withdrawn, boy, would the system be in a mess. Now, so we need to understand from a purely financial perspective, but we also need to understand from a workforce perspective. The NHS, I don't know the current number, it varies a little bit between 1.5 and 1.6 million. There are 800,000 or so in social care, and I've already mentioned several times the 6 million voluntary carers. So we're not far short of between 8.5 and 9 million people who are actively involved in the provision of care, let alone the 18, I thought it was 15, but 18 million who are self-carers with long-term conditions. And I, too, come in that camp and prefer not to be called a patient in that camp. And when we talk about clinically led system, we tend to talk about the doctors, the fewer than 70,000 doctors who are less than 1% of the workforce. And nobody really takes account of the fact that diagnostics is probably the most important place to invest money, because with good diagnostics, we would get people into the right pathways and the right treatment regimes, be it self-care or provided care, very quickly. And there are twice as many medical scientists than there are doctors. And they have never been in any discussion I've heard of in terms of system reform. When we look at nurses, there are 650,000 nurses, 40% of whom are not in the NHS, but actually there's only 1 in 8 social care workers for every one nurse. And yet the problem that we need to tackle is the problem of long-term care and provision, and particularly end-of-life care. Yeah. So we don't understand adequately the total workforce that we already have, and yet we work in these amazing silos. So the most important ingredient for me is to see transformational change to create a compelling and unifying vision that drives consistently throughout the whole ecosystem. And you cannot have that compelling vision that drives uniformly if we only, even in our wildest dreams at the moment, we are only multiplying the size of our understanding from one silo to a slightly different, bigger set of silos, we still haven't grasped the vision of how big care is. And the problem is that when you're working at grassroots level, you can't ignore the realities of all of these other players. And some of the most successful stories around better care provision are on the ground where teams have wrestled with this. And they've wrestled with it because the people above them don't understand the environment in which they're working. And if we could only see the vision for the totality of a care ecosystem from the top through to the bottom, then we'd have a good chance of delivering a better quality and a more cost-effective solution for everyone.
Thank you. Well, finally, we're going to hear from Doug Patterson, who's the Chief Executive of the London Borough of Bromley, and we've been talking a bit earlier about local authorities, and now we're going to hear from Doug.
Claudia, thank you very much. I mean, this is fascinating for me, sitting on the end of the line, and the last speaker, and I promise I won't hold you up too long. But it's very, very interesting, because I'm going to come at this from a different end. I serve the community in Bromley, 300,000 people, and the only reason my organisation, the local council, exists is to serve that community. And we serve that community through the democratic accountability that are our local councillors. And I'm really optimistic about the opportunity that's being presented here with the integration of health and social care. Because at present, my organisation, all my social workers, including all the social workers that work in children's services, and we haven't mentioned too much about them in terms of the increasing demands that that's going to put on the social care system, are geared up to help that community. And we don't draw a line between just collecting the council tax or dealing with their health. And I think it's a sort of common perspective that if you look at the changes in people's health over the past many years, it's not actually been the health service that's delivered on that. It's been education, housing, transport and the environment that have made or have contributed to those bigger improvements in people's health levels. Now, that's about a flow through into social care and health needs in due course. But I just say that as a point of where my organisations or councils are coming from. Bit of a generalisation because I can't speak on behalf of all the councils. But that sort of direction of travel, that we're very optimistic about it. But a couple of big challenges for us that worry me on that end of things that are going on. And I would use as my reference point Richard's slides, because I thought they were very telling in terms of me as a chief executive and local council. All of that is really important to me. Everything you said in the slides is really important, as is the issues that other panel members have raised. But two things that really drive it and that worry me is the difference in culture between my organisation and the NHS. And I only know what I experience from the NHS. I'm not in there, so I can't make that strong comment, but I worry about the different cultures. We're starting to do an integration on public health just now in Bromley, and that's working. But I see those tensions coming out, the different cultures and the way the staff are used to working. The other aspect which is complementary to that is the local political environment and this nature of local political choice. And if you start to say, as the government are doing, there needs to be a much more localised approach to things, then that may well mean that some local areas will go into conflict in terms of what's the needs of that local community, either with the NHS or with the government. And I'm in a Conservative council who are already at odds with a Conservative government on a number of issues, but that tension of localism, local choice, local well-being. Richard referred to the health and well-being boards. I think that's a fantastic opportunity, but the headline is that my councillors will not let that be chaired by anyone other than a local politician. And the democratic accountability is a big, big issue in moving this forward. Because my local politicians, if they're going to have a responsibility, they will exercise that. And up until now, they haven't had that sort of responsibility for local health services in that way. I think Richard referred to dealing with GPs. I think the only group that are worse than dealing with GPs are dealing with head teachers, and we have experience of that. But that whole skills agenda is changing as well. So maybe in local authorities we'll get rid of the head teachers only to replace by having to deal with GPs, and it's just a forever thus in our environment. But my final point is about, and Professor was making the point about doing this from the bottom up, and in a sense not letting managers or the bureaucracy or some of the systems get in the way of delivering quality services in whichever integrated way that's got to be for our local community. And that's a big issue for me in my organisation, that this bureaucracy, both in my organisation and in health, will it just get in the way and end up as not actually being able to seize the opportunity that's being presented to create something new? And every time I deal with the NHS just now, I just get a sense that the NHS as an entity, and understand that all those component parts, is just not going to let go. It's just not going to let this move on into a different environment that will allow us to get the improvement on the back of integrating health and social care. Thank you, Claudia.
It sounds as though, from what a lot of you are saying, is that cultural change is needed, as you see it, at so many different levels that it almost seems like the most enormous thing to ever happen, that you need cultural change for social services and the NHS to work together and for healthcare workers to work together, and cultural change, I mean, you're talking about cultural change amongst those going for the care, the patients, if I dare call them that, going for the care, and if you want them to see it all as not as their cosy NHS anymore and as something different, and maybe they're using avatars and so on. Is this, will the public, if you like, go in for this change? What will change their views about what they expect when they go to the doctor and how things are run? Perhaps you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a practical experience of seeing things that can be different, which is where I think demonstrating different models of care is so important. So when patients are exposed to different ways of working, it's interesting actually, because when you ask patients, are you satisfied with the current service? Almost always their answer is very positive, 95% happiness with general practice in particular, which is just wonderful if you want to take the result superficially. Show them a different model, and all of a sudden they realise how things could be different, and that's very much what our work around demonstrating is about.
Stephen, how do you think you could take the public along and change their views?
I completely agree on the culture change point, and as I say, I came in as an outsider and spent 3 months in the department doing this, and I did see, actually, some extraordinarily good people about, highly professional, very, very strong, good civil sense. But I also saw a terribly inwardly focused culture that is around a family, and I was an outsider, right? So they know what's best, and I'm an interfering bastard. Occasionally. Sometimes I was okay. But you know what I mean? That was very interesting. But what I think may well change is, I think we're seeing this with the treatment of older people in our hospitals now. I think we had a generation that experienced the move into the health service and how good that was, and are incredibly supportive of it for some extraordinarily good reasons. But we're now seeing the generation of, the baby boomers, whose parents, father or mother or relatives are going into NHS facilities and are receiving disgraceful care. I mean, when I say disgraceful care, that's what it is. And the CQS reports show just how bad that care can be. And they're saying, actually, it isn't good enough. So I think you have the interesting position of people are incredibly supportive of the NHS. They're supportive of the fact that it's universal, so it's free at the point of the end. That's very valuable. And people do have good experiences, but they also have bad experiences. And they know it's bad, and they know it can be better, and they're prepared, I think, increasingly to say, absolutely unacceptable. One of the things I said in my report, which Liberal Democrats sabotaged, was that we should introduce a right to challenge. Now, in the local government bill, in the localism bill, there will be a right to challenge poor service, and you will have to respond to that. And I think that's great, actually. I think that, allowing people to challenge the way you're funding, so you've got to think about that and then potentially put that up. And I wanted that to be applied in the health service. For two reasons, actually. The first reason is I think it's ludicrous that you can have a right to challenge your care if it's provided by the council, but if we've got integrated health and social care, if it's health, you can sod off. So I think there's a very practical reason why it should be extended. But more importantly, I think it will help drive up standards. It will help drive innovation. If, a group of parents get together and say, that ward, the service is appalling, we're going to challenge that.
Now, I'm aware that we're about to run out of time, but I do want to give you a chance if there's anyone who's got covered a massive number of issues here. But does anybody have any questions or comments or reactions to what people have said? No, that's fine. That's fine. I mean, there's many. We will. Oh, yes.
I'd just like to ask about how we harness that feedback we were talking about earlier to make that challenge real, how that group of patients in one ward in a children's hospital can have their voice held. And I'm, as Richard knows, I'm a patient and public representative on a health and wellbeing board, leading a work stream called Citizen Involvement, because I entirely agree. But I think we don't as yet have any support for Local Health Watch. We don't have patient opinion funded to each Links or Local Health Watch to make sure those patients' parents in the children's hospital are coming together in a way that's fed straight back to the Health and Wellbeing Board. We're not being given support either by the GP consortia, the list of 8 management consultants we saw earlier, that those aren't being given to health and wellbeing boards to fund their patient citizen involvement work streams. I'd really like to think about taking up Steve's point, because I am actually a diabetes voice, and I think working with Asthma UK and the whole Richmond group, there might be an opportunity there to come together and give support and maybe some academic support to Local Health Watch to make us into a bit more of a force, because we need some guns behind us and we don't have them at present.
I mean, James, can you see a way that people can get more guns behind them?
Yes, just to clarify on patient opinion, we've always given patient opinion away for free to Links, and we're happily do the same thing with Local Health Watch. In other words, we want people to use it more than they're using it at the moment, because we think that's the way to make it valuable for everybody. So if those parents on the ward that you talk about want to give their feedback but don't want to do it in person, they can do it on patient opinion today. And you can use it today in the local Link or in the Health Watch.
Yes, you want to come in?
I think in the future, I think you will be able to start using your locally elected councillor. And I think that's an opportunity that doesn't exist just now. Yeah. And you know why potholes and grass gets cut and bins get picked up? Because you go on your phone to your local councillor and they immediately think, well, I won't get that vote if I don't sort it. I think there's opportunities of that into the future. Not there just now. But as councillors take on that responsibility, and depending on what they're allowed to take on, that's another avenue.
Could I just say, I mean, I, very long time ago, because I'm old now, I used to be a councillor in South London. And it was at the time when we had councillors on health authorities. And I chaired a local health committee for my council. And actually, it was an excellent experience, because we took up a range of issues. For example, at the time, this was in the 80s, people needing hip replacements were waiting over 2 years. Now, you know, these are people in the community that needed support and help and all sorts of things, and they were being, and we sort of highlighted that as an issue. This was with you know, a big teaching hospital who, you know, that wasn't one of their priorities, but actually we forced it onto the agenda. So I completely agree with you. I think that will be an advance.
Well, I'm aware that we are out of time, but thank you very much to everyone on the panel for all your contributions. Thanks to the viewers on the web for listening in. And thanks again to the supporters of this conference. So there was NHS London, London Councils and the Mayor of London. And thank you to all the exhibitors and the speakers who were here earlier for their time. And thank you very much for staying right till the end, those of you who are still here. And don't forget, you can access all the presentations online for free, and the footage from midday tomorrow, so please do that. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.